guys, and welcome to Prose Before Hoes,
the podcast where we talk about what we're thinking, drinking, and reading.
We're gonna lock down to Electric Avenue. I feel like we haven't recorded in a little while. Last time we recorded was, I think, the week before Halloween, and boy oh boy oh boy, has a lot happened since then. What are you drinking tonight?
I'm drinking Ockentoshen.
Yes, Ockentoshen.
Which is
my favourite.
A beautiful single malt Scotch whisky from Glasgow. And it's divine, and it's a whisky kind of evening. So that's me.
It is a whisky kind of evening. The nights are getting long and they're getting cold. Slash, they're already long and they're already cold. You weren't lying, that does look like a big glass.
Yeah, but can I just say that there's this much is water.
You've put water in it, I understand. Yeah. I understand now. I am drinking a Paloma, which is a tequila-based cocktail with, you guessed it, tequila.
Tequila!
Lime and grapefruit soda. And it's actually one of those, like, pre-made cocktails because I'm just really busy right now. There's a lot going on, you know. Just, I've got a lot of social activities going on. Going clubbing a lot. Going to non-essential shops all the time. So I don't have time to make my own cocktails. But no, this was actually last week. We all got sent some cocktails from work because we did like a Zoom cocktail evening, which I forgot to attend. So now I've just got three.
Yeah, I was going to say, why? I didn't understand why you had these.
Yeah, they were meant for a work event that I did not go to. Because again, like I said, just really busy and can't remember the one social plan I had that week.
Where are they from?
So they're from a brand called Lollipop.
My boy Lollipop. Do, do, do. Go giddy up. That's probably the most cheer I've been all day. Savor it.
It's beautiful. It was so in tune as well. Yeah, they're from a company called Lollipop, who I think deliver cocktails anywhere. So if you are looking for a corporate or a personal event, this is actually not sponsored by Lollipop. But I'll tell you what, initial thoughts, I'm liking it. But, you know, we'll see how it goes down throughout the whole podcast. And we can touch base. We can circle back.
Circle back.
We can circle back at the end. How have you been otherwise, Elle? You had your birthday.
Yes, I had my birthday in lockdown. Not ideal, but we made the best of it and I had a delightful day. Who knew a lockdown birthday could be fun? Felt very loved. Had a nice video montage, kind of birthday scrapbook made for me by dear Raquel, who is a massive fan of this podcast.
Shout out to Raquel.
She's gonna hate that. Call her Raquel.
Yeah, we did. I wrote you a little birthday song in the video and then had to endure it being watched by several people on Zoom and immediately regretted my decisions.
Camilla made me an exquisite but monstrous. But that's important. Exquisite. Monstrously big. I thought it was assessing in its own.
It was a 16 serving cake for two people.
But we siphoned it off.
We did. People. We did some deliveries around the neighbourhood. It truly was the monster to my Frankenstein.
creature, not monster.
Creature. The creature to my Frankenstein. It was very much started making it, had a meltdown, bon appetit. James A. Acaster vibes.
Oh, it tasted so, so good though.
It was tasty. And I've got banana bread in the oven right now, guys. I've actually...
She's a new woman.
I'm a new woman. We were talking about how lockdown one and two were quite different, weren't we? I feel like first lockdown, I was like, going to be the best version of myself, you know, going to wash regularly, going to go for two walks a day, brand new exercise routine, going to get ripped. I don't know, feeling it. Maybe I'll do an Iron Man when we come out of this. And then got released for the summer. I had quite a lot to drink because I was afraid it could get taken away at any moment. And now lockdown two, I'm really becoming the worst and most base version of myself, but with baking involved.
I think that's allowed though, because it's winter.
Yeah. I'm getting like 15 hours sleep a night. It's not great though, because I do wake up and I'm like, who am I? Where am I? What is this? And also, you're really not meant to sleep that many hours. I have been getting to like 9 o'clock and I'm like, but what else is there to do?
Which thanks. Talk to me. Watch TV with me.
I was going to say we could sleep together, but that...
Talk about this.
Not that the kind of friendship.
The stakes are too high.
Think of the podcast. For me, it's a combination of, like, this isn't going to go on forever. I'll get my life together when it ends. But also, I'm so bored and tired of it. And also, it's cold and it's dark.
It's about getting through one day at a time. Just keep swimming.
Yeah. Good, like, vaccine.
Is that your like?
That is my like. My like is that there might be a vaccine. I'm glad to hear that the Oxford one is going well. Do you know how the Oxford one works? It basically tells the virus about how it went to Oxford until the virus gets so annoyed.
I know, you're so predictable.
And then it leaves. Ba-dum-bum. It's an interesting, because they've never made a vaccine like that before.
Just can't engage with this.
What have you been engaging with this week, other than me slowly losing my mind?
I have a music recommendation, everybody. And I know that everyone's asking for a playlist, and we will do one as a Christmas gift to you, perhaps.
It will be our gift.
All I've been listening to is an Australian singer-songwriter called Angie McMahon, and I feel like her music sounds like my thoughts, so now I just can't be alone in silence. I must have her music playing at all times. Probably quite problematic. I have today tried to, like, wean myself off it.
Yeah.
But right now, if you cut me in two, that's all you'd hear is just her music.
I'll go get a knife.
What's like that Twitter thing when things were Kate?
Oh, my God.
It's not really like that, but that's what I thought.
That came at a really bad time for planet Earth when we were all like in lockdown one and already slightly insane. And then it was like, but wait, maybe it's cake. I don't know Angie McMahon, so I'll listen to that on the podcast that we make playlist.
I added to our house playlist. She covered Knowing Me, Knowing You by ABBA.
Oh my God, already I'm there. I am there.
I think I might have even mentioned her before. I don't know. I don't know anymore. I don't remember a life before I listened to her. So
I don't remember you. I think that's a new one. I think it's a new one. I've been really enjoying Will Hislop on Twitter. He does these like videos on woke fuckboys. And there was a line where he was like, "You're pretty funny, actually." It was him on a date. And I just felt very triggered by that, because I've definitely been on dates where guys have been like, "Wow, you're actually kind of funny." I'm like, oh my God, no, not a woman with a sense of humour. You've got to be kidding me. Cuff me, I'm guilty. So if you would like to laugh, I would recommend going to Will Hislop's Twitter page. He did quite a funny video with the host of The Guilty Feminist, Deborah Frances White, for a charity. We've also been enjoying The Crown. That's how you know Christmas is coming. When we brutally assess the royal family in fictional, but let's be honest, not fictional.
It's not
form.
Fictional. It all happened.
Yeah, I keep reading the Daily Mail being like, royals furious over fictional affair plotline between Camilla and Charles. And I'm like, oh, honey, no, that actually happened.
That's my other big like is... This weekend, we're going to decorate the house for Christmas.
We are getting a tree.
We're going to drink mulled wine.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited. I'm very excited. I'm going to cycle and get us some Olenstein pastries, because you simply cannot decorate a tree without cinnamon slices.
They're really important as well. They're very important. Just to life in general.
That's another one of my likes. Mm. Can't believe we've made it this far without me mentioning it, but I would die.
So good.
I would die for them.
And like, it had been so long... I kind of forgotten how great they were, and then I had a bite and I was like, oh,
so good. I've also been listening to another podcast.
You're cheating on us.
I'm cheating on us. But it kind of ties in with The Crown, because it's, I don't know why, but whenever I listen to other podcasts, I never go for like the generic ones. Like, I haven't really listened to My Dad Wrote a Poem.
Sorry. You haven't listened to My Dad Wrote a Pono.
It's just me censoring it for the kids that might be listening. You all know what I mean.
Oh, no. Sounds
pono.
Worse.
Yeah, Pono does sound worse. I've not really listened to the big ones. Like, My Dad Wrote a Porno and Serial. But I tend to get into really niche, weird ones. I think I talked about one in the first episode, which was quite odd. And then I've been...
Is that with the gay Irishman?
No, that's I'm Grand Mam, which I still recommend and is fantastic. That was Dead Eyes.
Tom Hanks.
So I've been listening to You're Wrong About, which I think quite a few people know about. It's fairly popular, but I've gotten really...
Wrong About thinking it's niche.
That should be their next episode.
Loads of people listen to it. Okay, bye.
Yeah, so I've been listening to... Well, I started off with... I just wanted to kind of dip my toe in, because there's quite a few episodes and a lot of them are about very niche things. But it's really, really interesting. They do really incredible research and the hosts are very bubbly and fun. We wouldn't know that. We wouldn't know anything about that. But yeah, no, I listened to their first one on murder, just to hear about all the ways I was wrong about murder. And you know what? I was wrong about murder.
I have been telling you for a while now.
Yeah, it has come up. And then I got into the Princess Diana episodes, which I really recommend if you're even slightly interested in Princess Diana and the royal family, because it's just full of hot gossip. And then I listened to them before we started watching The Crown, so I've been annoying Elle while we've been watching it, being like, that actually happened.
I find it, because I literally just don't give a shit. I care more because you're telling me about it, but I just objectively don't give a shit. Yeah, I love The Crown.
The way that they convey information on the podcast and kind of, I don't know, I suppose I'm quite nosy. I always find it quite interesting to,
I'm not nosy at all.
I'm both nosy and I force intimate details of my life. So it's like...
And I'm very closed and...
And doesn't kill me when I force intimate details of my life on her constantly.
Now for judging a book by its cover.
So in this segment, we're gonna talk about a book one of us hasn't read, which I know sounds slightly contradictory to the entire point of this podcast, but I promise we will be talking about things we have read afterwards. In this section, one of us will have read a book, the other person won't have. The person who hasn't read the book has to guess the plot of the book on its cover alone. This week for judging a book by its cover, I have given Elle the cover of Perchance, one of my favourite books of all time. It's Donna Tartt's The Secret History. The cover is black with silver text and a kind of emblem, a gold emblem in the middle. I think you could probably Google it. I don't think there are many covers for this book. It's probably had the same one for a while. What did you think, Elle?
Okay, well...
She's now holding the book to...
To get information. I've really not got a lot to work with here, but I've zoned in... I kind of ignored the title, not gonna lie. Zoned in on that emblem. Because I think...
It's all you have to go on.
It's all I have to go on. I think it's a depiction of Artemis, the Greek goddess of hunting, chastity, and nature. And so I'm bouncing off away. I had to write down some of my thoughts because I take this podcast very seriously.
She's written down her thoughts next to what looks like a list of mental maths.
What even is... Oh, it's from when I was buying all those...
But none of the maths problems have answers next to them. It's just a series of maths problems.
It's a metaphor for life, okay? Yeah, you know what? I'm just going to keep the mystery alive with that one. I'm not going to explain it. Yes, okay. So, an emblem of what I think is the Greek goddess Artemis... And she's also a patron of young women and a protectress of childbirth. I hope this is all right, because if I've remembered this wrong, I'm going to look really stupid.
I don't think you'll look really stupid for not remembering the very specific things that Artemis is responsible for.
I know, but these are quite specific. So, but I guess I could have just got the name wrong. Anyway, and then also Artemis is the twin of Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going off that.
Yeah.
For what I think this is about. Did I even describe what the emblem was? Her with a stag or a hunting dog.
Yeah.
And then there is some olive trees, maybe? Yeah.
I mean, if it's ancient Greece, I think we can assume yeah. There are some olive trees. They love their olive trees.
But I could be wrong. It might not even be that, but I think it is that. So, from that, I feel like I could be making some leaps.
Leap. Bound.
Ancient Greece.
Uh-huh.
Classical thinking. The birth of thought, philosophy, all that vibe.
The birth of thought is a horrific phrase, which I would like to ban from this podcast.
The birth of thought?
The birth of thought.
Okay, so I'm going to go with a learning environment. School, life, university, that could work. Young women, because she's the patron of like young women and childbirth and all that jazz. And then because she's also like a hunter, I think there's going to be a dynamic of... It's like tense and very intimate, like there's a circle, no one knows who's predator, who's prey, who can you trust, nobody knows. Also, because of the like female, the strength of female character and that vibe, I'm gonna say that there's a male presence that could be not a threat, but maybe a threat, but I think there's a lot of female characters. Male character influences plot in some way.
Okay.
Because I'm thinking Artemis has her twin is Apollo, so that's like a do you know what I mean? I've really zoned in.
Okay? She's really zoned in.
Yeah, so I feel like maybe a smaller knit group, and it's quite intense. Lots of like, I don't know how to describe this, drama, but maybe
lots of drama.
But maybe like between people.
Okay.
Not necessarily like whoa. Yeah, learning environment, presence of a man, mainly about women, looking after each other, but also fucking each other over. Secrets. Who's got the control? Who hasn't?
You will be amazed to hear that in the book, The Secret History, there are some secrets.
I didn't even think about that, because at no point did I actually register the title. I just really went in on the emblem.
So I'm going to just let you know from the off, I've got no idea who that is on that little emblem on the front cover. But I absolutely love how you ran with that.
But that's all there is on the cover.
Yeah, I know. I don't care. I read the book.
Unbelievable.
Right, should we read that? To be fair, your mood will lift when you hear that you've hit the nail on the head in some ways, not in others, but in some. And I think anybody who's read The Secret History will be quite impressed with what Elle just did.
Oh.
Truly deserving of the accolade modern classic, Donna Tartt's novel is a remarkable achievement, both compelling and elegant, dramatic and playful. Under the influence of their charismatic classics professor... A group of clever, eccentric misfits at an elite New England college discover a way of thinking and living that is a world away from the humdrum existence of their contemporaries. But when they go beyond the boundaries of normal morality, their lives are changed profoundly and forever. Okay, so this is set in a university. I actually don't want to go too much into detail, but the book starts by revealing that there has been a murder of one of the main characters. Actually, I'm going to read the first paragraph, which is very short of the book, because I think it's...
I mean, that can't give anything away.
It doesn't give anything away.
Because it's the first paragraph.
Well, actually, the first page of this book essentially gives the plot away. But because Donna Tartt is an excellent writer, you keep reading. Okay, this is the first few sentences of the book. Does such a thing as the fatal flaw, that showy dark crack running down the middle of a life, exist outside literature? I used to think it didn't. Now I think it does. And I think that mine is this, a morbid longing for the picturesque at all costs. It's a bloody fantastic book, and I'm about to rant and rave about it. I've not read anything else by Donna Tartt. This is actually the only book I've ever read by her, because I read this, then everybody else said her other books were not as good. And I didn't want to mar or taint this in any way, which may be now reminded of me. Also, her books are very long.
Yeah, that is...
It's a chonky boy.
How big of a... Yeah.
It is over 600 pages long. But it's a very good book, so you don't mind when you get into it. Perhaps I would feel the same way about her other books if I ever got around to reading them. But hey, we're here. We're talking about The Secret History. The story is essentially about one of this kind of group of really close-knit students. Only one woman in the group. The rest are all men. And they are kind of seen as
what
the intellect.
What is gender? And you know,
in this book, it's important. But only in this book. Not in real life most of the time.
Well, I picked up on gender being important. I maybe just got it the gender wrong.
Yeah. So it's essentially this group of close-knit friends. Friends as you can interpret that as you wish.
Predator and prey.
At university in New England, and somebody dies. One of them dies at the beginning of the book, and the book is essentially the story leading up to that. And there's one of the characters, the narrator, is a kind of outsider who comes from a very different background. All the others are quite rich and wealthy, come from like New York City. He's kind of come from a small town in America.
We've got a Nick, like in Gatsby.
We have a bit of a Nick in Gatsby. Yeah, I mean, Donna Tartt, the way that she writes in this book is just absolutely phenomenal. Coleridge said that Shakespeare always makes apprehension like predominate over surprise, and Donna Tartt really does this in this book. You do not wonder what might happen, but you kind of spend the whole book really worried about what will happen. The characters, they absolutely revel in their own awfulness. They're pretentious, they are amoral, not immoral. And I think what really centres throughout this book, and what you definitely picked up on from that emblem, is that Greek tragedy.
Ah.
Yeah, because they're it's kind of focused around their classics lessons.
Ah.
So they're kind of constantly playing with Greek concepts of tragedy and morality, but applying them to real life. And I think that's what ends up getting them in trouble.
Right, okay.
But yeah, the characters, they really revel in their awfulness, and the kind of scope for how heinous their crimes could be is always up to play for, because of how just amoral and not existing in the real world these young kids seem to be. They're so caught up in their own moral superior or even intellectual superiority that they think they're above everyday morals.
So you know that one of the main characters has died at the start.
Yeah.
Do you know how?
No.
Okay.
I think it gets revealed fairly early on, like, how, but not how.
Okay, yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Cause of death, yes.
But not how.
But not how.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really tense book, but it's inviting. Whenever I think of this book, I kind of think of, like, have you ever been to New England in the fall? Because that's kind of when it's set. So you can imagine this really picturesque, beautiful scenery, and then these just...
Yeah, hideous people.
These just quite hideous people.
Are they all very
people.
Attractive?
Not all of them, actually. I think the focus really is on... I think... I assume that they are.
Mm.
But I think the focus more is on their kind of intellectual discussions and interactions. Okay. Like the narrator says in that first paragraph, he's obsessed with beauty, but it's never sexual. Kind of high pretensions mixed with human weakness.
Are the characters actually intelligent?
Yes. No, they are all incredibly smart.
So it's pretension and intelligence. It's not one.
No, it's both.
Okay. Okay.
It's a dangerous combination of the two. I think I finished the book and I still don't know if I feel utterly cold towards the characters and completely like you got what you deserved with a kind of morbid fascination or if I really pity them. And it's something that I still battle with.
Every day.
Which I think is a really interesting way for a writer to be able to leave the book, to be unsure whether you... pity characters or whether you just completely don't care
to have
about
strong
them.
Feelings but not to 100% know what they are
exactly. And that is kind of this book kind of left me reeling when I finished it. Like I said, the narrator's obsession with beauty is almost perverse, but it did lead me to one of my favorite sentences in any
we
book.
Love a quote. We love a quote.
I need to find it because I've not bookmarked it.
Oh, absolute amateur over here.
I know, amateur hour. I'm sure that we'll cut this time down.
I'm keeping it all in. The suspense is killing us.
Neon lights, Motel 6, Dairy Queen. Colours so bright they nearly broke my heart.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That hit me. Hit me in a strange way. Then I think about it a lot.
Yeah.
I think about it whenever I see pretty colours now. Whenever I see something beautiful in nature, I think, oh, that's heartbreaking.
When I was young, and actually still now, one of my favourite lines of any song is from Suck It and See by Arctic Monkeys.
Mm.
And it's, you've got that face that just says, baby, I was made to break your heart. Breaking hearts, baby! Breaking
books
hearts.
And songs, breaking hearts. Who needs men? We can do it all by ourselves. I think the way that Donna Tartt's able to write about this elusive secret society but make you feel like you're the kind of extra member, like you don't participate in the book, but like you're really there.
Do
and you are
feel
pretty...
included or do you feel like a bit of an outsider?
No, you feel very
included.
You
so
feel...
you're one of them.
Yeah, and I think which in a way forces you to kind of self-reflect on some things. There was a parallel that I thought was interesting with the kind of Lord of the Flies where kind of isolation distorts your morality, but in this case it's an intellectual isolation where they're so in their own, and I think it's very relevant to the world today, and that people get so caught up in their intellectual bubbles that it distorts their morality. And obviously Lord of the Flies, it's like a Lord of the Fries.
I really want
chips. The classic.
Now. I really want
Lord
chips.
Lord of the Flies. It's a physical isolation, but I think it's interesting the way that it very subtly throughout you realise that when people isolate themselves intellectually, it can lead to immorality. Which I think it reminded me a lot of kind of the political bubbles that we get caught in, only interacting with people, like-minded people, and even though it seems like we have the best of intentions. If you don't look at the world as a whole, you don't understand the world.
Mm. Yeah, there's definitely, like, something to be said where you... removing yourself from the world to figure things out...
Yeah.
...can be really useful. But it can't be forever, because the conclusions you make... And this is, like, true in, like, intellectualism or just personal or just, like, anything. Sometimes you need to remove yourself from a situation to figure out what you actually think...
Well, you can never see the whole picture if it's right up in your face.
But then you need to be back in the situation to apply it. Otherwise, it means nothing.
Perspective. I think perspective is an incredibly important part of being a good person.
And being a clever person.
And being a clever person.
It's Which not, is more important. No, I'm kidding.
It's not clever and it's not funny to only interact with like-minded people and not broaden your horizons. And potentially, it leads to people dying.
Bloody hell.
But yeah, I can really, really recommend The Secret History. I just think Donna Tartt writes in such a beautiful... I think haunting, like, really is the right way to describe it. Like, you are so comfortable because of the way that she writes, but also so on the edge of your seat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really feel like you're in the story.
Does it linger with you?
It really does. Yeah, I think it does. I mean,
in a bad way? As in, like, in a good way, but as in a
It makes you uncomfortable. I think she makes you uncomfortable. But never in a way where you want to put down the book.
I think it's good to be uncomfortable.
I think it's great when a writer can make you uncomfortable, but not do so, I'm trying to think of the right word.
Gratuitously,
or even grotesquely. Mm-hmm. You know, the way it's done is so subtle. So I can really, really recommend The Secret History to anybody. I actually can't think of anybody who reads who wouldn't like this book. It goes quite quickly. It didn't actually take me that long to get through. Wait until we talk about A Little Life. That's a long book.
This is the problem, though. I like doing this podcast. You're welcome, everyone. But you end up, especially with judging a book by its cover, because the whole premise is that the other person hasn't read it.
Yeah.
You end up with a really fucking great big list of things you want to read. But then you've got to read them, but then also read everything else you're reading, because you can't be talking about them. Maybe we could do an episode where it's like role reverse. And we revisit when the other person's read the book.
We should definitely do that. So let us know if you would be interested in that.
Camilla's going to... Wait, is it still recording?
Yeah, it's still recording.
Camilla's going to check her banana bread. I really, really hope it's gone well, because her heart will be broken if it hasn't.
Oh my god, it's so beautiful.
I think probably take it out now.
Alexa, cancel timer.
15 minutes, timer cancelled.
Truly, I have overachieved. We haven't tried it yet, but I'm confident. I'm feeling good.
It smells good.
Yeah, it smells bloody good. So yeah, talking about Secret History reminds me of another book. And like The Secret History, it feels culty. It's not a cult. It's a cult in many ways, but it's not technically
like
a cult.
Like an intense circle, small circle of friends. So I picked up on that as well. I'm actually really chuffed with myself.
You've done great, sweetie. I'm so proud of you.
I'm proud of myself.
You should do this for a living. Can you do this for a living? No.
Oh, that was so mean to bring me up like that.
But it reminded me of another book, which is actually literally about a cult. It's kind of based vaguely off of the story of Charles Manson. The book is The Girls by Emma Klein. And it just, I don't know why, I drew this link in my head and then I was like, I want to talk about this book as well because this book is really, really good. Again, kind of quite haunting and compelling, but it's kind of like a sugar glaze over it because it's this 14-year-old girl, Evie Boyd, who lives this really humdrum, boring life in California. Emma Klein describes it as the brainless dream of 60s California. She's kind of stuck in that, mm-hmm. you know, motel drive-ins, everything pastel, nothing has any depth, which I think, you know, that makes sense to me when I think about kind of the 60s in America. I don't know why. I feel like it was all quite, you know, with like the emergence of pop art and everything. I'm not saying that they didn't have meaning, but everything felt quite shallow and kind of like a moving picture as opposed to reality. But yeah, anyway, so she sees these girls in a park having a good time. They seem really carefree. She's desperate to be older than she actually is. And she ends up joining a cult.
It happens.
It happens sometimes. You know, I went to Clapham Common the other day and came back and I was in a cult. No, it's actually very serious.
A cult of like takeaway coffee and pastries. The cult of Clapham Common.
Cult of sausage dogs and
Australians. Oh my god, I'm exhausted from seeing so many sausage dogs. Sorry, continue.
We love a wiener, but there are a lot. Yeah, so it's kind of reading books that remind me of cults always makes me feel like I'm a captive audience to a captive audience. Which is like a weird level. Yeah. But I think Emma Klein writes really well about how kind of innocence is cut clean with a knife, with kind of violence and corruption. And I think this book really touches on the almost the irony of imprisonment of liberties. It's like we think like free love, all of that is going to be like really freeing and stuff, but the way that she frames it shows that actually these concepts can become prisons if we if we execute them in a certain way, which obviously Charles Manson did, and kind of use it as a manipulation tool rather than an actual tool of enlightenment. Emma Klein is a really, really brilliant writer, and she's got another book out called Daddy, which I have wished for Christmas. Mum, if you're listening to this, please buy it for me. I can't justify buying any more books. But yeah, I just wanted to really quickly talk about it because it was another culty book that I think you should pick up. Yeah, wonderful, slightly haunting way of writing about the gross and the grotesque. Again, kind of like Donna Tartt. But yeah, much shorter. Like... much shorter if you're looking for a quicker read.
Is it... has it written, like...
She has a really interesting way of seeing the world. So it's written very intensely. Kind of like you're sat in the intense sun, if that makes sense. You know when a book feels like heat?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what the book feels like.
Okay.
It's a good summer read. I'm sorry that I'm recommending this in December. But hey, maybe you want to feel like you're somewhere else right now. I wouldn't blame you.
Things are so bad, you wish you were in a
cult.
Is it all from the girl's perspective?
Yeah, it's all from Evie Boyd's perspective. And she's, it's amazing because she is portrayed as this, to be honest, quite dull character, but because Emma Klein writes in such a way, she balances both the importance of Evie being quite dull with obviously the importance of writing well.
Boring people having interesting things happen to them.
Yeah.
Does that make them an interesting person?
No.
Or does that make them have an interesting life?
It makes them have an interesting life.
But if you can still be dull and have an interesting life, it's not gone well, has it?
Yeah.
Just something for us all to ponder.
I mean, I guess it depends how you define interesting, because I think an interesting person can make a very normal life.
Yeah.
So perhaps their life is not interesting. Perhaps you have to end it by saying they've just had lots of things happen to them. But if you can't engage with that, like if you're not on a level where you can engage with interesting things happening to you, have they really happened to you?
Well, they have, but you're just dull.
Yeah. It's a different experience, I think, if you're not interesting enough to reciprocate and like engage with. I think that the thing is also... she is dull, but that awareness of her dullness and the kind of drone of her everyday life is what I think drives her to do it. So there are many levels.
That is interesting. So maybe she's interesting.
Maybe she is interesting. You read the book and you decide. Yeah, let us know what you think.
It's one of those ones that I've like always had on the periphery and just never got around to reading. Which, unfortunately, is probably going to be the case for most of the books in the world, because I can't read them all.
I always think about, you know the movie About Time?
Yeah.
Where the dad, like, uses his time-travelling skills. Oh, don't even get me started about Time. Oh, if you haven't watched About Time, what have you been doing? It is the best movie ever. I think it's my favourite movie. But also, you will cry. But yeah, it's got Bill Nye in it. Need I say any more?
Man, you will
But yeah,
cry.
Basically...
I could cry right now. Yeah. And I'm not a crier, and... Whew!
Yeah.
Whew!
To sum it up in one line, which gives absolutely none of the plot away, a man uses his time-travelling skills to read books.
Amongst
many other things happening, which are much more central to the plot, but not nearly as heartbreaking as that. What have you been reading?
Talking about heartbreak.
My everyday life.
Do we all know? Yeah, I feel like we all know by now that I love a short story. Because
you talk about them every week.
Yeah, I just can't really commit to like a...
I can see now why you were kind of looking at The Secret History and going, can I commit?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, obviously I've read long books.
And oh, low-key flex. I have read the longest books. I've read books longer than any of the books that you've read.
Okay, obviously...
I'm the best reader.
Obviously I have. And obviously I've enjoyed them. But I just feel more akin to a short story.
Yeah.
And Raymond Carver, who wrote... What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, which is a short story in this collection, and then the book's called What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, is my main man because of it, because his whole sort of writing style is like slices of life. It's like little glimpse and snippets into life where nothing and everything happens, which is just my kryptonite. And it's like, what's it called? I think the term's dirty realism, where it's looking at the life of ordinary people and ordinary lives and sort of disappointments and heartbreaks and almost like a mundanity, but not mundane, because within that, the personal relationships, there's a lot going on.
Well, yeah, no, I think... I mean, I think for most books, even if they are set in, like, a crazy world where loads of stuff is happening, what a good book really comes down to is the relationships.
Dirty realism is also, like, kind of, like, a middle-class kind of not fixation, but about the middle classes and that connection to disappointment and ordinary lives and the sort of normality.
Yeah.
And then the harsh truths within that.
Yeah.
So that's like a broader thing that I like. And different authors engage with it in very different ways. So, for instance, Angela Carter, who we always shout out, she does dirty realism as well in some of her stuff, but she obviously does it in a very different way to Raymond Carver. So it's like a thing that can be taken in many different directions.
Yeah, have you ever read Stoner?
Oh my God, we're coming to that next season because we both... adore that book.
We do both adore that book, but small spoiler, I feel like Dirty Realism is probably...
Yeah, actually, I'd not thought about that.
Yeah, that's the book I always think about when I think about just, like, life happening. Anyway, we're gonna...
Oh, I love that book so much.
Stay tuned, because we're gonna need to talk about Stoner. But anyway, so how does Carver kind of tackle that in what we talk about when we talk about love?
Okay, so the tone is very colloquial. It's quiet, mm-hmm. but intense.
Yeah.
What we talk about when we talk about love probably isn't my favourite of all of them, but it's the one I'll talk about because I think it's a good one to give you an idea about his writing in general. I really want to do it justice because I absolutely adore it, and it's very, like, specific tone, so I don't want to get it wrong, but... So his writing in general, and especially what we talk about when we talk about love, is all about dialogue.
Yeah.
So there's an irony there,
mm-hmm.
which I'll get to in a minute. But then, because of how he writes as well, the importance of metaphor is quite big, and that lots of things are said from, like, very minor sort of aesthetic things within the settings, because they're just very ordinary spaces. It conveys the sort of pregnancy between... You're going to hate that phrase, aren't you?
I already hate it so much.
But pregnant is the perfect way to describe the pauses and the what hangs and the tensions between the different characters.
Sometimes I find when I take a break between sentences, a baby does pop out. No, I can't.
That is such a narrow-minded conception of pregnancy.
Pregnancy, famously one of the most adaptable words.
Something, a silence can be pregnant with anticipation.
It can be pregnant with anticipation, that's true. We don't have to like it being as such, but it can be.
So I would say that maybe the two main themes, or the most obvious themes in it, are the elusive nature of love,
mm-hmm.
and how there are very clear, strong feelings with... So there's four characters and they're all having a drink, I think in one of their homes, four friends talking about love and their experience. Okay, there's one guy who's divorced his wife, there's another lady who's broken up with a past partner who was abusive to her, but she maintains that he loved her, so there's intricacies about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, they're all talking about love and from their different points of view.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, they all fall quite silent. So the elusiveness of love with the inadequacy of language.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because it is, it's impossible to talk about love.
But it's not important, but see, what I really like is that I feel you can't define love because it's not neat and concise. But how you can understand love is by talking about it. So what we talk about when we talk about love, everything they say arguably is love. And if people don't agree with that, then their reactions to that gives ideas about what they think love is. So it's like an intangible thing that you can't grasp, but is a very strong gut feeling.
Well, that's the thing. Like, when I say that it's impossible to talk about love, I mean, when we try to talk about love, we know what we mean, but we're always dancing around the point.
Yeah, which is why it's probably such a big deal if you find someone that gets it.
Has your same love language. What's your love language?
We actually talked about this in summer. And the consensus
I'm not touchy-feely at all. I hate people touching me, like public places or something.
I can attest to that because Elle will formally ask me for a hug when she needs one, and otherwise we do not touch. But I'm like that as well. I'm not hugely like...
But I can be like... There's no way to say this without sounding weird. I like being touched by people I like.
Yeah.
And so I said that and everyone was like, yeah, because that's love. So it's one of your love languages. You're just very dramatic in the sense of, like, if I don't love you, get the fuck away.
Yeah.
So apparently touch.
But that can be what, like, in a way, like, all of us, we've now gone from highbrow literature to BuzzFeed quizzes.
This is horrible.
Seamless segue. I don't know if I've... I probably should...
I've not done an official quiz.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't...
I feel like yours would be, like, acts of service.
Yeah, well, see, this is the other thing. Then there was a debate between gifts and acts of service.
Those are different.
No, I know, but they can cross over.
Yeah. You do like a little gift.
I think gifts are so important, but the...
It's not about the thing.
It's, like, the act of service of the gift,
yeah,
but with, like, a little bells and whistles on top.
Yeah. I know that that's one of your love languages, because Elle, whenever she goes to the shop, brings me back a banana yogurt.
Yeah, literally.
And I love that.
It's important. It's important.
I don't know. I feel like I need to do a quiz now. I feel like I want all of the things 100% of the time. Like, I want people to be doing nice things for me while giving me gifts and hugging me.
No, but a love language is about what you do.
No, well, it's both. It's what you do and what you want.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know it was about what you wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
That's the whole point, is like, you're meant to, when you have that, you know, when you get to that point in your relationship where you have the seminal conversation of new relationships where you're like, what's your love language? And you both log on to BuzzFeed together, heedy with lust.
And if it doesn't work out, then you just break up right then and there.
You end it all. So yeah, here we are trying to talk about love and dancing around the point.
I can't even believe that we've talked about love languages. I'm talking about my favourite collection of short stories, which is all about, like, nuance and subtlety. And
hey, the love languages are nuanced. Okay, you haven't done the quiz yet? No judgement.
Should we do the quiz and then we'll report back?
We'll let you know in the next episode what our love languages are, guys, so that you can love us in the right way.
But yeah, so essentially, of the title short story, it's that words aren't really enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I take that, because I'm really interested with language and philosophy of language and how it can be applied and all of that malarkey.
Mm.
And yeah, what I take away is that the conversations they have all contribute to a better understanding of love.
Yeah.
Including the more uncomfortable sides that I think lots of people maybe wouldn't like. And there are characters, so with the one that was in an abusive relationship, there's one line where it's like, if that's love, then I don't want it.
Yeah.
And it's the idea that love isn't one, or love is one thing that manifests differently with different sets of people, because everyone's different. And when you get two people together, you're not going to have that again. Yeah. And then a sort of more binary notion of love is this and that, which is all part of the conversation, but interesting, because by the very nature of some people thinking that love is more of a binary thing, and if that happens then it can't be that,
yeah,
by very virtue of that being part of the conversation, it kind of undermines it. It's just everyone's different perspectives of love in it is really interesting at communicating to a sort of bigger picture, because then there's a couple who are quite touchy-feely with each other but don't really reflect that much. So I guess you could view it as each character sort of signifying a different love language. Absolutely not. Raymond Carver, I'm so sorry. But, like, communicating a different facet of love, and then they all come together and the mess of their conversation is also quite clarifying.
Yeah. Well, I've always been, I mean, in the same way that the way that we try to describe love and the kind of almost impossibility, I think we'll probably all spend our whole lives trying to understand exactly what kind of subjectivity of experience as well. And it's not just about the way that we describe love, but it's when I'm in love, that's probably feels different to me what it feels like for you to be in love.
Well, yeah, because we're different people and we're in love with there's so many intersections of different variables.
So when you say I love you to somebody and they say I love you back, you're probably talking about completely different things. Take from that what you will, but
then that's the commonality is what makes something work, isn't it? That's what's so amazing about something working, is that you've got two completely different variables that have, like...
interlapped.
And it works. Overlaps. Interlinked, overlapped. Interlinked.
Interloped.
Mm.
Oh, not that one.
A few of the other stories in there. One that's really stayed with me is the one... I can't even remember what it's called now. It's one about, like, a bass farm, and there's an outsider...
Sorry, the fish, or the four-string guitars.
That's a bass.
So, just to clarify for our listeners, it's not a farm of four-string guitars. It is a farm of fish.
And then there's also one called Why Don't You Dance, which... I don't do favourites, I love them all, but Why Don't You Dance is special, and that's what... Have you seen the film Everything Must Go with Will Ferrell in it?
No.
It's like when he's got a yard sale and he's sat on the front lawn and he's like...
Oh, God, maybe I have.
I love that film. I think it's really good. And that's based on Why Don't You Dance? There's lots of... I'm not going to remember them all now. There's lots of films and things that are really influenced by this collection of short stories.
Yeah. I actually think I'm going to grab that off you immediately after this because I'm a glutton for punishment. And I love reading about love.
But it's like, it's just so proper and it's so real.
Yeah.
10 out of 10.
We've touched on cults and we've touched on love. What else is there? My dislike this week is a little nugget. A gift, you might say. An act of service to you of me embarrassing myself hideously in Sainsbury's. And I've managed to keep this from you because I wanted to live surprise you on the podcast with how much of a fool I made of myself. The other day, Elle started singing the first line from Nothing Compares to You by Sinead O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, love that song. Forgot about that song temporarily. Gonna like that. Add that to my Spotify. Was having an issue with my AirPods.
I like what this is doing.
Yeah. Having an issue with my AirPods and was listening to it on repeat.
Yeah. In Big Sains. That's a mood.
Yeah. And it stopped and I was like, oh God, and I had my hands like full of stuff and I was like, whatever, I'll just leave it. I had the AirPods in quite tight. So it turns out I was just walking around Big Sains with Nothing Compares to You by Sinead O'Connor playing out of my pocket, not even that quietly. I do not know how I didn't hear it.
Oh, and I took my AirPods. I can't believe you managed to keep this from me. That is incredible.
Mortifying. And I got to the cashier and I took out my AirPod and I was like, this has been playing on repeat.
Oh my God.
And you know what? That's not even my dislike. My dislike, I didn't get very many approving looks, but that is a class song and I really think Big Sainsbury's could have appreciated that better. Anyway, top that. Like I said, a glutton for punishment.
Oh man, that is so good. Thank you for that gift.
You're all welcome. And if you would like, a live performance, might I recommend that you go to the Clapham Big Sains every now and then, because I'm a regular there.
I don't really have any dislikes.
That's amazing, given the state of the world.
Well, obviously I have a lot of dislikes, but not... Work's quite stressful at the moment.
Your work is quite stressful at the moment.
That can be my dislike. I'm looking forward to Christmas. I'm looking forward to just, like, having... like, stopping.
Mm.
I just feel like everything's quite relentless at the moment, so I'm just looking forward to... Because now it's like, I stop on the weekend, and I'm quite good at being like, right, no, now we have fun. But then Monday is a kick in the face.
Do you know what? It is just impossible to work from home constantly and not feel like you want to smack your face against a wall when Monday hits, because you're like, I have been here all weekend, and now I am still here. And I'm expect you just, really, I feel like none of us have felt like we've gotten a break at all. Even when we take time off, you're still in your office, technically.
Yeah,
it's mentally draining.
I can't believe I haven't been in the office since March.
A madness.
And I'm not going to, I haven't seen any of my colleagues
Yeah.
since March.
I've seen a few of them. Penguin have been kind of back and forth a bit. very much at the discretion of us choosing when we want to. I just work so much better in the office and really feel like I need that separation. Mm. But alas, we keep getting sent home. My hope for 2021 is that we're allowed to really find a balance. Like, we've now developed the technology, we've shown it's not essential. And some days, you know, especially like working in publishing, like having days where you can just read a manuscript without people constantly coming up to your desk. Mm. And I think every job has those elements where you're like, I just need to be in my home doing this instead of people constantly asking questions.
Yeah.
Speaking of stressful work, how's that whiskey going down?
Really good. I really want to have another one, but probably shouldn't.
My Paloma. Wait, do you want to try?
Yeah. Ooh, I don't know what I expected, but I didn't expect that, but that's nice.
I think we should try and make a Paloma. It's good. I think it could be less sweet.
Is it a Paloma or a Paloma?
I think what we've established from this podcast is that I don't know how to say words, so we'll go with your assumption. Probably Paloma. I was thinking of a way to justify how I was doing it. No, it's probably...
What were you thinking of? Paloma?
No, I think I was just saying the word Paloma wrong. I'm doubting everything.
Honestly,
now.
Honestly, this happens every week.
Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. We'll be back, well, in a couple of weeks anyway, with a Christmas special.
Woohoo! I just hit myself in the face.
Elle is so excited that she is hitting herself.
I just think it's important that every time I go, woohoo, I am actually putting my arms in the air, which is quite tragic.
You got to believe in it. You got to believe in it. Dream, believe, achieve. And on that note,
au revoir, les enfants.
Auf Wiedersehen.
If you've enjoyed listening to Prose Before Hoes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Otherwise, we'll have no idea.